Thanks for listening to the History Buff podcast with your resident history buff and Berlin tour guide, Arty. If you're enjoying the podcast, then you can really, really help us by liking and sharing the episodes on social media and rating the podcast on your streaming platform. If you'd like to see more History Buff content, then please give us a follow on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for your support. Today, we are going to talk about one of the most, if not the most, pivotal moment in Chilean history, and that is of the 1973 military coup. So it had far-reaching consequences for Chile, which are still felt today. And for this discussion, I am joined by Teo, who is a fellow history buff. Welcome, Teo.
Hola, Arti. Muchas gracias por tenerme.
All good. I'm very pleased to have you. Would you like to just quickly introduce yourself, and then we can get started?
I'm a Chilean citizen. I'm a lawyer. And I'm fellow history buff.
Well, this is a very emotive topic in Chile still today. It has repercussions that are still felt in Chile today. So we're going to try and be as sensitive as we can, objective as we can. But obviously, there are obviously certain things that inspire emotions. And it is a very emotional topic. So basically, in order to understand why the 1973 Chilean coup happened, we first of all have to go back over the 20th century beforehand in Chile. So basically, up until the 1920s, Chile had actually been famous for being quite politically stable. Okay, it had actually been, compared to its neighbors, relatively politically stable country with a very big mining industry. But this all changed after the First World War. Obviously, the First World War wreaked havoc in Europe, which meant that basically a lot of Chile's customers for copper and everything else that it was mining had no money, or they were getting their resources from other places. And so this meant that Chile's economy went into decline. And you actually had a Chilean coup also in 1924, didn't you? But this didn't last very long, the regime that it installed. And a democratic president was then sworn in again later that year, I believe.
Alessandri Padre.
Yes. By the 1960s, you had growing tensions between right-wing conservative and left-wing liberal forces. And the political spectrum, included traditional conservative parties. And obviously, at the end of 1800s, with the Industrial Revolution, you had the rise of leftist movements, socialist parties. Okay. And in Chile, these two, over the course of the 20th century, these two wings were becoming increasingly fractious. Now, a lot of people say that Salvador Allende was a communist, but I think it's not very helpful to say that because communism by its nature is not democratic. And the thing about Allende was that he was very concerned about coming to power through democratic and constitutional means.
Yeah, I have to say at that point that communism is not democratic or not democratic. It's just like a political view in that sense.
By its nature, the communism of the Eastern Bloc states was not democratic. In fact, it was anti-democratic. Okay. However, that is not what Allende was actually. Yeah. He was not a Marxist-Leninist.
What is to be a communist? To be part of POM? To be friends with Trotsky? To read Trotsky?
Yeah.
And Allende will always be seen, I believe, as a communist because he ruled and the last party that left his side was the Communist Party. The changes were coming. The changes were coming and Unidad Popular, I believe, in that moment when between being elected and being sworn into power Allende, was the belief that there is a possibility and there is interest and intentions to create a more socially equal country. You know?
Exactly. So the social unrest increases throughout the 1960s. And the periods kind of leading up to the 1970 elections saw, increasing protests, and various groups advocating for change. So basically, you come to the 1970 presidential elections. So Allende, he doesn't run just for the Socialist Party. He runs for the Popular Unity, the Unidad Popular, right?
Actually, there's something that when they were choosing who's going to run for president for Unidad Popular, Allende was not the first one to get picked.
So it was almost by accident.
Yeah, kind of a beautiful accident, because he was a very important figure. He was a public health specialist.
Now, something that we will come on to is the involvement of the United States in Chilean politics. So the United States, throughout pretty much the whole of the early part of the Cold War, was very worried about communism's spread. And obviously in the early 1960s, you had the revolution in Cuba. And so that meant that communism was right on the US's doorstep. And so the US took steps to basically spread kind of, well, they took steps to provide support to conservative factions in different American countries. Okay, so in South and Central America, and basically undermine leftist movements. So this is basically what Allende is up against from the very beginning.
And also say, sorry, that as you said, like Marxist-Leninism, the USSR not that they looked with bad eyes Chile, but they didn't support Allende.
Because he was a constitutional socialist. Because that's the really important thing to get to get right about Allende, is that he was very, very...
He was a Democrat until the end.
He was a Democrat through and through. Yes, until the very end. He was very concerned about doing everything legally, constitutionally, okay, and all about democracy and keeping it legal and constitutional. So I guess you could call him, a constitutional socialist. So in the 1970 presidential elections, Allende wins a very narrow victory. Okay, so you have three candidates standing in the election, which were Salvador Allende, Jorge Alessandri, and Radomiro Tomic. Now, Allende gets 36.6% of the vote, whilst Jorge Alessandri, which I would guess is his main opponent because he's the right wing. So Allende gets 36.6% of the vote. Alessandri gets 35.3% of the vote, and then Tomic gets 28.1% of the vote. Okay, so with this, Allende actually wins. And basically, the system in Chile at the time is quite complicated.
The day Allende is elected, Agustín Edwards leaves Chile to go to work as an executive in Pepsi Cola. But he wasn't
in the United States, obviously.
Yeah, of course, in Washington, I believe. And he wasn't working for Pepsi Cola. He was doing lobby there to put more pressure in the States to make a coup in Chile. And that's a very interesting doctrine or philosophical idea from Claudio Durán, a Chilean philosopher now in the University of Ottawa. It's called La imagen angustiosa del mundo. The anguished image of the world.
That sounds about right. And obviously the fact that it's such a narrow margin of victory, you know, and the fact that Allende didn't have an absolute majority, it obviously set the stage for these challenges. And as you said, he was up against these forces from the very beginning. And the divided nature of the electorate and the ideological polarization within Chilean society. So Allende's election sends shockwaves throughout Chile, throughout South America, throughout the world, especially to the White House. Okay, now President Richard Nixon is completely shocked by this because Allende has made history by becoming the world's first Marxist to be democratically elected to power. And Nixon doesn't like this, okay, because he believes that essentially communism's steady advance has taken another step towards the States, towards the United States. Okay. And he doesn't like having this left-wing president right on his doorstep. So he orders his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, who died just a couple of weeks ago at 100 years old, to essentially make Chile scream. Okay. Now, it's important to remember, for some context, that at this point, the US is really at the peak of its economic and political power. Okay. It's the world's most dominant power, obviously with the Soviet Union, but it carries a lot of economic clout, okay, and does a lot of business with Chile, and actually owns quite a lot of the industry in Chile, mostly the copper mines. And this is actually something that Allende had pledged to change. So Nixon basically orders an economic blockade against Chile. Now, the thing is, for the first couple of months or so of Allende's rule, it's actually, or first year or so, it was fairly successful, wasn't it? Because he brought prices down, I think, artificially low and increased wages. So that obviously increased prosperity. But, and also then nationalized key industries like the copper mines. So took them off because before they had been owned by private businesses, lots of them American.
In that point, it's interesting that Unidad Popular had the, I believe there were 50 puntos de Unidad Popular. And one of those things that they had to do, and they did till the coup, of course, was half a liter of milk for every kid in Chile. Because malnutrition was part of everyday life, you know?
Well, Allende introduced that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, half a liter of milk for... So there were things like that. So it was just to give dignity to a country that didn't have any.
Yes, and he was implementing social reforms and also land redistribution. So, you know, basically trying to make the state more equitable. So, obviously face economic difficulties because of the American blockade, it actually then makes everything a lot more expensive. Inflation becomes very high, and you have shortages of basic foods like flour and sugar and all of this kind of stuff. And basically, this is because Chile had such strong opposition from conservative factions. Because also, you have to remember that you also had people in Chile actively undermining Allende's government. People who, right-wing factions who were literally almost carrying out guerrilla warfare. Not guerrilla warfare, but like they were attacking infrastructure.
No, they were terrorist attacks.
Yes.
There was Padre Libertad, was a extreme right-wing movement that they say they were the ones that killed
Jonas Schneider. Oh, that's it. Yeah, Patria y Libertad.
Padre Libertad.
So in English, that would be heritage and liberty.
No, like, patria is...
Nationality.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the country, you know?
Yes, okay. Country and liberty.
Yeah.
So yeah, from the very beginning, yeah, because you still, even after, because obviously Allende has come to power using democratic means, so it's still a democracy, so people are still allowed to have other points of view. So the polarization doesn't go away, okay? It just means that this other side of it is in power.
It's at this point, I have to say about the parliamentary elections in the, I think it was March of 73, that they have to, I think, change all the Cámara de Diputados and the Senate.
The MPs.
Yeah, the MPs and half of the Senate.
Okay.
And the things were going very bad for the government, of course. So they thought that there is no way Allende can continue after this.
Yes.
But Unidad Popular got something like 40, 45% of all the seats in parliament.
Okay. But not a majority.
No, not a majority, but the people thought before the election that there was going to be a total disaster.
Oh, okay.
So the thing about that was, like, still a lot of people was with the Unidad Popular, but were the professional groups or the gremios, like the truck drivers and such, mm-hmm. that were working directly in overthrowing the government.
Basically, at every turn, Allende is being undermined, obviously, by the most powerful country in the world. Now, Allende does try to do something very... I mean, I guess you could say it was clever, but in the end, it actually ends up hurting him. What he does is, when he comes to power, he knows that the military don't like him. So he actually tries to sort of extend an olive branch, and he does actually work with them, okay? And he actually installs them in positions of power, okay? And does work with them because he knows that they're not on his side. So Chile's military, it had always made sure to stay out of politics, but it was also known to be a very good military. I believe it was the best trained, I think, in Latin America.
When Chile beats the Peruvians and Bolivians in the Guerra del Pacifico, as we call it, the first part of the 1800s, they say that President Santa Maria, that was president at the time, won the war and was very happy, of course. But the military came to him and said, "Mr. President, we have won in the north now. It's time to take back Cuyo, Mendoza, and La Patagonia and invade Argentina."
Oh, okay.
And Santa Maria said something like, "I don't want to see the Chileans carrying the pianos through the mountain from Buenos Aires."
Oh, really?
So in that time, Chile was the most powerful military country in the Pacific.
Yes. That was until Allende came to power. And from the very beginning, You had people in the Chilean armed forces who were out to get Allende. The most vociferous of these, the most keen to see Allende's removal from power, was someone called Admiral José Toribio Merino. And he was the head of the Navy, wasn't he?
Yes.
So he was an avid anti-communist, okay? And he really, really, really wanted to see the end of Allende. You also had General Gustavo Lee, who was the head of the Air Force, and General Cesar Mendoza, who was also an army general. So you had these three, and then you had a fourth, General Augusto Pinochet. Now, Pinochet was actually had a fairly good relationship with Allende, didn't he?
It's, I don't know how to say, but Pinochet never was like...
He was fairly unremarkable.
Like fairly unremarkable in the sense that he didn't have the intentions of Merino, the late,
yes,
or, well, Mendoza also, Mendoza of the Carabineros.
He was head of the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And he joined the coup like the night before, like Allende in the morning couldn't reach him and he said, okay, we don't have Mendoza. But Pinochet was like just useful for the intentions they really had, because he didn't have a very good political formation. But one of the first speeches of Pinochet, and what turned out to be a good part of this country, he was promising the people color TVs and cars.
Right,
like that was the thing. He was not necessarily, well, a demagogue, of course, but he just knew what he had in hand, show it and say, hey, this one, what's going to happen? And he did it because the form of country we created was possible in a system that has the power and the weapons to do it.
Yes. And the thing is, as I said, Pinochet, who was only made commander-in-chief of the army on the 23rd of August, 1973, because, yes, he had very good relations with Allende. And so Allende promoted him to commander-in-chief. And yes, as I say, he actually had a fairly good relationship with Allende.
Before the coup of the 11th of September, the 6th of September of 73, Colonel Soper is the name, did what was called a tanquetazo, the failed coup, the first try of coup, let's say.
Yes.
And he took the tanks outside and tried to go to the Moneda and overthrow Allende. The ones that came was General Prats of the army.
Uh-huh.
And by his side, stopping the coup, was Pinochet. So that shows what Pinochet really was. He wanted to climb in the power ladder. And he did in any means possible.
You know? Yeah, and he was basically a man who was essentially in the right place at the right time. So the social unrest in Chile, from spiraling inflation, from huge queues of people having to wait for the supermarket, for basic things like bread. So basically, Chile's economy is tanking very, very badly. People are being pushed into poverty. You had lots of strikes. And it's becoming quite a big crisis for Allende. And so obviously, as you said, on the 6th of September, you had a failed coup. And after this, Allende realizes that something's going to have to give. And so he decides that he is actually going to organize a referendum, I think basically on whether Chile wants him to continue, isn't it?
Yes, yes. He planned to have a referendum the 11th of September.
He was going to announce it on the 11th of September.
In the Universidad Técnica del Estado, because the coup was not going to happen the 11th of September.
Yes. So basically, he plans this referendum and he wants to do it. He wants to announce it at the Universidad Técnica de Santiago del Estado. And he is going to announce it on the 11th of September. However, the 11th of September is the fateful day. So,
Martes triste.
Martes, so sad Tuesday. So, Tuesday, the 11th of September. So, in the days leading up to this, all of the armed forces leaders had decided that they were going to overthrow the Allende government. However, there was one man who was actually holding out until the very end. And guess who it was? It was Pinochet. Pinochet actually was very reluctant to do so. And it was up until, I think, a few days beforehand, Merino, who was the main organizer of the coup, he went to Pinochet and said, you are either with us or against us. And they basically had a sort of signed agreement that they'd all signed. And Pinochet actually said that he, in the moment, literally in the moment, that he couldn't find a pen. And so one of the other officers lends him a pen, but he still sort of dithers and delays. So what's strange is that actually Pinochet seems to be the one actually almost the most reluctant to help in the coup. But anyway, so we come to the day of the coup. So in the morning, the Navy begin by taking over the port city of Valparaiso. So they basically create a sort of naval blockade and they cut off communications and they take over the radio stations and they start broadcasting the fact that a coup is happening. So at 7:30, Allende arrives at La Moneda, which is the presidential palace in Santiago. And he then hears that pretty much by this point, the whole of Chile is basically under the control of the military, apart from the center of Santiago. And so basically the military, it's been very well organized. And basically by 8 a.m., the whole of the country, apart from the center of Santiago, was under military control. However, Allende, he broadcasts an address to the nation expressing his determination to defend constitutional government, saying that he wasn't going to resign and that he rejected the military coup, because also the plotters of the coup had actually said, we demand that Allende resign and that there would be safe passage for him out of the country on an aeroplane. But Allende refuses this. Okay. And so then throughout the morning, military forces led by Pinochet conduct operations in various parts of Santiago and they seize government buildings, ministries, communication centers, and basically they essentially surround La Moneda with tanks, and you have soldiers on top of ministry buildings next to the La Moneda Palace. And basically the coup plotters, they say to Allende, who is holed up in La Moneda with his aides and physicians and various other people close to him.
The GAP was called.
Yes.
El Grupo de Amigos del Presidente.
That's it. And the group of friends of the president. And they say to them, if you don't leave, we're going to start bombing. And so it's by this point that inside Allende actually also has his two daughters, one of whom is very pregnant, 7 months pregnant, and he orders all the women to leave. Okay. And so they manage to slip out of a side door and manage to flee the area. So Pinochet, when Allende defiantly refuses to leave again, even after this ultimatum saying that they were going to bomb the palace, they said that they were going to start it at 11 a.m. 11 a.m. comes around and there's no airplanes. And it's because the airplanes have had to come from the south of Chile and they've also been bombing other areas. And so they actually come late and then arrive. Two bomber jets arrive at 11:15 and they start bombing La Moneda. And this is where you have the, I don't want to say iconic images, but I guess you could say infamous image of La Moneda being bombed. Now, the bombs don't actually completely destroy the palace, but it starts a fire. Okay. And the people, the president and the people with the president in the palace at the moment of the bombing were thrown from the ground. So it was a very forceful bombing, but yeah, it starts fire. But Allende continues to resist. He's not going to resign. He's been put there by the people and only the people can take him out, I suppose you could say. So he continues to refuse to step down. And what's quite sad in a way is that he called Pinochet and Pinochet doesn't answer. And Allende famously said, poor Pinochet, he must have been arrested. So he obviously thinks that Pinochet is not involved and that he stayed loyal until the very end. So La Moneda is surrounded. It's on fire. The soldiers are closing in. And basically, Allende orders most of his staff to leave. They go out of a side door and they're ordered to actually lie on the ground with their hands behind their necks. And the military constantly threaten to run over their heads. And you can actually see images of this online. And you have a tank with the president's aides just lined up on the ground with their hands behind their neck. But Allende stays in La Moneda, okay? And he then broadcasts a final speech to the nation. Oh, also something to mention, that by this point, the military plotter, the coup plotters have taken over all radio stations apart from Magallanes, which is the last remaining pro-government radio station, which I think is in the south of Chile. So his speech went like this. My friends, surely this will be the last opportunity for me to address you. The Air Force has bombed the towers of Radio Portales and Radio Corporation. My words do not have bitterness, but disappointment. May they be a moral punishment for those who have betrayed their oath. Soldiers of Chile, titular commanders-in-chief, Admiral Marino, who has designated himself commander of the Navy, and Mr. Mendoza, the despicable general who only yesterday pledged his fidelity and loyalty to the government, and who also has appointed himself chief of the Carabineros. Given these facts, the only thing left for me to say to the workers, I am not going to resign. Placed in a historic transition, I will pay for loyalty to the people with my life. And I say to them that I am certain that the seed which we have planted in the good conscience of thousands and thousands of Chileans will not be shriveled forever. I address, above all the modest women of our land, the campesina, who believed in us, the worker who laboured more, the mother who knew our concern for children. I address professionals of Chile, patriotic professionals, those who days ago continued working against the sedition, sponsored by professional associations, class-based associations, and also defended the advantages which a capitalist society grants to a few. I address the youth, those who sang and gave us their joy and the spirit of the struggle. I address the man of Chile, the worker, the farmer, the intellectual, those who will be persecuted because in our country fascism has been already present for many hours, in terrorist attacks, blowing up the bridges, cutting the railroad tracks, destroying the oil and gas pipelines in the face of the silence of those who had the obligation to protect them. They were committed. History will judge them. Surely Radio Magallanes will be silenced and the calm metal instrument of my voice will no longer reach you. It does not matter. You will continue hearing it. I will always be next to you. At least my memory will be that of a man of dignity who is loyal to the workers. The people must defend themselves, but they must not sacrifice themselves. The people must not let themselves be destroyed or riddled with bullets, but they cannot be humiliated either. Workers of my country, I have faith in Chile and its destiny. Other men will overcome this dark and bitter moment when treason seeks to prevail. Go forward knowing that, sooner rather than later, the great avenues open again, where free men will walk to build a better society. Long live Chile. Long live the people. Long live the workers. These are my last words, and I am certain that my sacrifice will not be in vain. I am certain that, at the very least, it will be a moral lesson that will punish felony, cowardice, and treason. Wow. Very, very, very powerful words. Really, really, I have to say, I get quite emotional reading those words. The thing is, he actually did most of them. I think it was improvised, mostly. Was his last speech.
I was telling you about the suicide of Balmaceda, was the president that in the end of the 1800s, that he committed suicide in the Argentinian embassy and use also those kind of words. Don't put yourselves in danger. Yeah. Don't let a massacre begin, you know.
Yes.
And Allende also in these last moments, because we didn't talk about it in that moment, but there were two factions in the Unidad Popular, if you like. One was El Avanzar Sin Transar de Altamirano, where you had the Movimiento de Izquierda Revolucionario, MIR, El MAPU también, entre otros, and the other ones that were just more moderated, right? So he, in that last hope of saving the constitutional government, he speaks to Miguel Enríquez, that was the leader of MIR, and he couldn't do much.
MIR being the paramilitary wing of the...
Oh, no, the MIR was a military wing of the Socialist Party.
Yes, yeah.
And, well, in the other faction, the most moderate faction was the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm. Who were the most supportive of Allende. Because actually, up until the very end, there's actually quite a bitter exchange in Allende's last moments where a Socialist Party worker tells him that they're ready to defend him, they're ready to defend Allende democracy. But Allende actually is quite scathing and says, well, the Socialist Party has never had my back. You've just made problems for me. And that's actually because the Socialist Party have not liked how he was very accommodating to the military. And the ones that were the most loyal to him were the communists,
yeah.
I think.
And in that point also, some things that haven't been recorded or we don't have a lot of information is how it went down in places. There were the industrial neighborhoods, los cordones industriales of San Joaquín or Cerrillos, for example. Yeah. We don't know how was the total casualties, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Because the defense of those places, because those factories were going to, were in that moment in a mixed form of the workers and the owners. But everything, when the coup started, all the agrarian reforms and the copper that it was kind of from the state, that hasn't changed, but it has its legal things, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, those were things that we could never account for, because those places were just taken down, you know, yeah, by force. And there are also people in the buildings that were shooting military to protect the president and La Moneda also. They disappeared and...
Yeah, the desaparecidos. We'll come on to that. So this speech, which in my opinion, one of the greatest speeches ever given, very emotional. And I recommend everyone listening to go and listen to it on YouTube or wherever, because it's a very, very stirring speech and definitely one that I think will go down in history as one of the greatest speeches ever written. And so 3 p.m., the military overruns La Moneda, enters, okay? Allende goes into a room. I believe it was, I can't remember the name of the room, but basically he told his staff that he just wanted to sit down, goes off by himself and into a room in the palace, and his doctor, can't remember his name, open the door just as Allende shoots himself with his rifle. Shoots himself twice in the head, so commits suicide. So he wanted to die rather than hand over power to the military, to the coup plotters.
In that way, Allende knew that was the only way out, because if he left the country in an airplane, shut down the airplane,
yes,
or kill
and,
him.
And,
or...
and the thing is that there is actually a recording of Pinochet and I think the head of the Air Force.
Light, Commandante Light, I think.
Anyway, there's a recording of Pinochet and I don't know, some official. And basically the official is telling Pinochet, Allende's not leaving. He's not leaving. He's not going to go. And Pinochet is becoming increasingly frustrated. And he does become frustrated because, you know, as we said, the jets arrived very late to bomb La Moneda. And basically, Pinochet sort of gets increasingly angry and shouts at the official and says, no, 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 he's going to get on a plane. He's going to get on a plane and the plane is going to take a fall. So this is recorded conversation, and you can see it on YouTube. It's all declassified. So the coup plotters then take power and they immediately declare martial law, and a curfew is declared for 6 p.m. So no one is allowed to leave. They actually order people who are at work, they're not even allowed to leave their places of work. So they and basically say that if we see you on the street, we'll shoot you.
Well, the curfew on the 11th of September was there was like a window of time where you can move. It was like on the midday or something like that. But then everything was closed, and as you said, if you go out, you're gonna get shot.
Yes.
Until the 13th of September.
Yeah.
That they started opening, and that was another thing, that when the coup was in process, there was a lot of there were no food, no gas, etc. But in the 13th of September, when all the commerce goes up again, open their doors,
yeah,
there is...
Well, and you know why? It's because America then suddenly, you know, opens the blockade.
No,
and...
No, not because of that. Because the people that were trying to overthrow Allende were hiding the food.
Oh, wow.
That was very, were very impressed because there was fuller food.
So then their thoughts probably are then immediately like, oh, life is much better under the...
Yeah, because it was part of the plan to overthrow the government.
Yes. So, and that shows you that it was obviously very well planned. Now, so they declare martial law. So that basically dissolves Congress, dissolves constitutional government. And basically, there is now a dictatorship in Chile.
The coups in Latin America were going to happen.
They were always going to happen.
Yeah. Chile had it very rough. I think
the Chile, the 1973 Chilean coup, I think is definitely known as, I think, one of history's most
bloody, sadic.
Most sort of dramatic and most intense.
Yeah.
Do you think, had the US been not so involved, do you think the coup would have happened?
As I was saying before, like,
if they hadn't undermined Chile so much during Allende's time in power, do you think the coup would have happened?
Probably not. Probably not. Probably not, because Allende would have stepped down in a referendum, or at least do a referendum and see what happened.
It's always a great what if. But I mean, at the end of the day, the point is the United States was, you know, written all over this coup. And
in every coup in Latin America.
Pretty much, because they were so worried about communism, the spread of communism, because obviously the Cold War was at its height. So the United States was very sort of nervous, very anxious. Obviously, that doesn't excuse what it did. But that's really sort of the reason why they supported all these coups. So yes, that's the thing, is that when the junta, the military junta, comes to power, they implement neoliberal policies that were basically recommended to them in a pamphlet made by these people called the Chicago Boys. Now, something else that was quite, well, showed the intent of what the United States wanted to do, they basically made education in neoliberal philosophy free for Chileans, I think in the 1960s. Okay, so this shows that, you know, the United States always had the intent of essentially kind of spreading its neoliberal ideology. And so Chileans could go there, study for free, and then they brought this ideology obviously back to Chile. And they basically produced a pamphlet about the economic policies that the junta should implement. They gave it to Pinochet, because Pinochet had no idea about the economy. He had absolutely no idea about the economy. So he was given this pamphlet, and he essentially implemented all of the recommendations. The ensuing military dictatorship lasts for 17 years. So Pinochet remains dictator for these 17 years. So in the 1980, a controversial referendum actually approves a constitution. Okay, this is very important. We're going to come back to this in a second, because it has repercussions in Chile today. And the thing is, the constitution concentrated power in the hands of the executive branch and allowed Pinochet essentially to remain president. And it essentially provided a kind of a legal framework for Pinochet's rule. Also, you have the suppression of labor unions. Okay, and so you then had also people who were opposing the regime were hunted, kidnapped, tortured, and we don't really have definitive numbers of the number of people that were killed in the Pinochet regime. It's the most common number that I come across is around 3,000 deaths and many thousands more desaparecidos. And so basically, by the end of the 1970s, in 1980, Pinochet orders a referendum where he says, "Do you want me to continue?" And they vote yes, but there is widespread reporting of irregularities, okay, in the voting. So that gives him another 8 years. So he basically tries to legitimize himself. However, over the course of the 1980s, people, and obviously over the course of the 1980s, you have Mikhail Gorbachev take power in the Soviet Union. The Cold War starts to sort of wind down. Okay, the relationship between Moscow and Washington is
and the economic crisis, world economic crisis. I mean, the Western world at least also did something very important in Chile, like almost bankrupts the country.
Right.
And that's when, as we are in a neoliberal system now, or in means of implementing it,
yeah,
Chile creates this system of provisional system of private
ownership.
Private ownership, and quote marks, that basically the money of the workers goes to these financial institutes,
yes,
that are the AFPs, that just uses that money to fund to the provisional, los fondos previsionales de las personas,
son provisional funds of
los fondos previsionales de las personas eran llevados a estas empresas financieras privadas que...
In English.
Yeah, no. Ahora sí, again. So So the new system implies that the workers had property of their ahorros. How do you say ahorros?
Oh, I'm not sure. Of their
savings.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a private
equity.
Yeah.
Private equity. So they think that they had ownership of it, but they didn't.
Yeah. No. Until today, they don't have.
I think people by the sort of mid 1980s can see that communism's days were numbered, and so basically, obviously, when the junta took power, they had very good relations with the United States, with Britain. Actually, Margaret Thatcher was a big fan of Pinochet.
A big friend also.
A very good friend until the very end, and fought against his repatriation to Chile but we'll come on to that. But basically, Chileans start advocating for a return to democracy. Okay, so it actually turns into big protests, and Pinochet, who realizes that he, you know, doesn't have without the support, the solid backing of the US, I think he realizes he has his back against the wall. So he calls another referendum in 1988 and basically says, hey, do you want me to carry on for another 8 years? And I think he believes he's going to win it, and he doesn't. People vote for him to leave power, vote for him to step back. And he does so he calls a general election, I think, in 1989, which he doesn't stand in. And his associate candidate, I think, comes second.
Yeah.
So the kind of Christian Democratic, or I don't know, right, the right-wing candidate comes second. And then...
Boogie.
Yes.
What's the last name?
And the winner is Patricio Aylwin?
Aylwin, sí.
Aylwin. And so he becomes president in March 1990. And however, Pinochet does not step back from politics entirely. He actually becomes a lifelong senator.
There were movements like La Asamblea de la Civilidad, for example, that was banished from history. No, you can go in the street, ask a politician, and he was not going to know what it is, because there were the professional associations, the workers and the students that wanted to, of course, take Pinochet from power, but at the same time, rebuild the institutions of Chile.
Yeah.
But they didn't come to a good end. They do anything finally. And this was the only way to take Pinochet of power with his annuance, right?
The general election 1989, Patricio Aylwin wins, assumes power in March 1990. And so you have the transition back to democracy. And Pinochet remains in politics, okay? And he still has a big presence, okay? That is, however, until 1998, when he goes to London for an operation on his back, I believe it was. And whilst he is in the clinic, he is actually then arrested. Okay, the reason he is arrested is because Spain has managed to get a warrant for his arrest for the murder of, I think, seven Spanish
citizens
during the dictatorship. So he's arrested. However, he manages to basically put off being...
It's extradited, but he wasn't extradited.
He wasn't. And the reason is because at that point in Britain, we had Tony Blair as Prime Minister, and the former Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, lobbied for him not to be extradited back to Spain. And however, Tony Blair does eventually decide to extradite him to...
No, he went free and went back to Chile.
So Tony Blair then ends up allowing him basically to go back to Chile. He goes back to Chile, where he does have to resign as a senator, I think. Yes, he resigns as a senator, gives up his seat in the Senate, and then eventually dies in... I think in Chile, they do actually begin to prosecute him, but by that point, he's so old that they're like...
I think he died in the year...
2006.
2006, 10th of December, that it's the day, the International Days of Human Rights.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
So that was the Chilean coup and obviously the ensuing dictatorship. But it's important to remember that when you talk about the Chilean coup, it is a very emotive topic here in Chile today. It's a very controversial topic. And the reason is because Chileans are still sort of reeling from it today. Now, it kind of all came to the fore in 2019 basically when you had a spiraling kind of cost of living.
It's not that the cost of living has always been very high. The thing was, like you said, as one of the Piñera's ministers said, that you have to get up earlier in the morning to have a low transport fare.
All still present today in Chilean society. And by October, you had a comment made by the transport minister who told people to basically get up earlier if they didn't want to pay too much for transport fees, for commuting and what have you. And this triggered a huge wave of protests, okay, anti-government protests. And this then led to a big discussion in Chile about the fact that the constitution is the Pinochet era constitution.
The movement started in great way thanks to the school boys and girls. How do you say that?
The students,
high school students. Because as I was telling you, one of the most famous signs people put up was "Hasta que valga la pena vivir," till it's worth living.
Right.
The Constitution of Chile is, of course, a problem and is the great legacy of Pinochet, but also like the labor's law, the provisional law, yes, the health law, the educational law
that he introduced.
Everything, you know, it's we can go all day from the things that till today are from the dictatorship that we haven't changed, yes, that are the same as they were during the dictatorship.
Yeah.
And the constitution, every constitution, we in Chile, in the States, in Argentina, everywhere, you have constitutional supremacy.
Mm.
So it's the most important law and nothing can contravene it. And so that's the route we have to take always by the constitution. The first groups that started like saying that the constitution has to change was, as I was telling you, the Asamblea de la Civilidad, that during the dictatorship, before the referendum of 88, of sí y no, they say, we can't go back to democracy if we have the same legislation and the same laws and the same system of the dictatorship.
Yeah.
So they were the first ones, no doubt. Then Ricardo Lagos, that was a president, says that the constitution is his because it has his signature.
Yeah.
But he didn't change the constitution in a way that it's important to change the constitution. So in the first 10 years of the first decade of the 2000s, at the end of the first decade, it appeared an organization that was called Marca AC, Mark AC. And AC meant Asamblea Constituyente, because they were fighting for a change of the constitution. And people said about AC, which I was part of it in some way. I was very young anyway, was in the university.
Okay.
These guys are crazy. Changing the constitution and marking ace. No, these guys, no, they're fucking insane.
Wait, you thought that?
No, people. Okay. No, I was part of the movement, I was saying.
Right.
So
well, I didn't realize that it happened as early as the 2000s.
No, in the second decade of the 2000s started like this movement.
Okay.
Like with visualization in the media and in place. O sea, not in the media, because they believed they were crazy, you know.
Yeah.
Because why are you going to change the constitution? We are Chile. We are the Puma of Latin America, the Oasis of Latin America. We still have, I believe, till today, that image of Chile as a great and prosperous country, you know.
Yes.
And that the Asamblea Constituyente movement died. Like
the Constituent Assembly, that's it. So that was set up in 2020?
Yeah.
And basically, I remember the first Constituent Assembly was a very progressive one, which was, I think, led by a Mapuche woman.
Yeah, Lincoln.
Yes. And they drafted, I think, what was the world's most progressive constitution, which had abortion, which enshrined abortion rights, gay rights, all of this kind of stuff, and then put to a referendum, and it was rejected.
Oh, it's sad. That was the thing I was telling you. You know, when you read the constitution of a country, like I don't know, you read the Constitution of the States, the Second Amendment, let's say, you know, how is the gun violence in the States? Yeah. You see the country in the Constitution.
Well, that's because it's a very outdated Constitution. I come from Britain and we don't have a Constitution. We have an unwritten constitution.
Yeah, but
which I think is a lot better in terms of when you want to adapt to, you can adapt to like the modern day. But it's obviously quite dangerous because, you know, if you don't have a constitution, that leaves it open to, you know, attack from, you know, people.
Yeah, there are, that's the thing. There are movements now, and I can't remember the name of the professor of Harvard Law School that wrote against constitutionalism.
Right.
Because the constitution,
it binds you.
Yeah, it binds you in a way that if it's not made sovereignly by the people,
exactly.
In this case, it's very clear that it isn't. It has the problems that it has today.
And it's designed. And the thing is also in such a divided country like Chile, it's going to be very hard to find a consensus. And the thing is, with a thing like a constitution, you definitely need probably at least 2/3 of people to vote for it.
Yeah, and in the case...
And that's never going to happen in Chile.
Yeah, and in the case of the first draft, as we call them, of this very progressive constitution, I campaigned for it. I went to the voting places to like see as apoderado, we call them. I wanted a change, you know.
Yes.
That's the thing. I mean, I've dreamt about in this country to have a constitution that represents a country that wants to go forward, you
yes.
know. But and I thought we were going to win and wasn't be wonderful, etc. But as you said, it was never meant to win.
But also, there wasn't there a lot of disinformation?
Yeah, but before going to that, like making a very progressive and inclusive and constitutional, like that was the draft. In a country like Chile, it has no sense.
It was never going to win.
It's never going to win. If it won, it's probably going to end very bad because the powers that be, you know, wouldn't allow it.
And so there might be another coup.
Yeah, actually, I thought is that any result has to be with a big margin because
right.
if El Apruebo won with like 1% or less than 1%, the implementation of this very progressive
yes.
constitution is going to end very badly.
No, the thing is, with something as big as a constitution, you need at least 60% of people to vote for it, definitely.
And that's the other thing. You know, when I think of constitutions, how they form, they are not created by these organs. Not that I'm against or in favor, but Iceland tried to do it, and I think the constitution is still in the parliament, and they don't want to pass it because it was made by the people.
Yeah.
And the Icelanders?
Did
like a very good job in the constitutional movement they had after the subprime that the banks in Iceland had more debt than the, how do you say, PIB?
The what?
The Producto Interno Bruto.
GDP.
GDP, yeah. They had more debt than all the GDP. That is.
Yeah.
from the whole country, you know.
Okay, right. Well, I mean, the thing is, all this talk is kind of giving, it's sort of, because, for example, the British constitution has just evolved to be the way it is. And I think, to be honest, I don't think there could ever really be a constitution in the UK because, like you say, it's a very sort of divisive thing and it's just not. And because societies, and also, by the way, saying Chile is divided, it's not just Chile. The whole world is divided. And what I will tell you is that, and I talked about it also on the episode about Evita, but it's all become a lot more divided with social media. And I think part of the reason why the progressive constitution lost here in Chile was partly because of sort of spurious claims put out about the constitution on social media and in the media. So the constitution was rejected by, I think it was 55%?
Or more, maybe.
Okay. Sorry. Well, anyway, then the conservatives, the right wing, got a crack at rewriting the constitution, which was last year. And that was rejected. So that shows you that, unfortunately, the divisions that, you know, existed even before Allende through the 20th century do still exist in Chile and run still very deep.
I mean, I as I I think I mentioned that this movie, La Batalla de Chile, is a very long documentary. There are parts when there are groups of sindicatos, we say, unions.
Trade unions.
Yeah, workers union. When you see how they spoke back then with a very rich language, knowing of philosophy, of economy, something that you still see in some union labor unions today. I have the opportunity to work with or being part of some law centers that teach union law. But now, back today, there is nothing of it. The country has culturally is in a cultural decline, in a big cultural decline. That's how you see, as we spoke earlier, like the police, when the estallido in October of 2019 happened, people were saying, we need to not eradicate the police, but eliminate yes. Carabineros, make a new one, or at least reform it.
Yeah.
Now, if you say that, you probably want to be, you say, no, this guy is crazy. No, right. Carabineros are saving us from violence, et cetera, et cetera. And with the with this constitutional organs that were going to make the new constitution, the first one, they had a lot of people that made their names in the estallido social in La Revuelta. And then it failed miserably because efectivamente, the press, social media, disinformation.
Yes.
And some events, you know, this event is crazy. There was a manifestation in Valparaíso where a guy like took the Chilean flag off his ass.
Okay.
And that thing cost like 1 million votes to the Apruebo. Because people don't have political culture. They don't know.
They're not informed.
Like the thing with Carabineros. It's evident we need a change with Carabineros. Yeah. It's not the moment to talk about it. But now we love them. And then we have this organo constitucional run by progressive powers, fails miserably. And then an extreme right, because it's Partido Republicano, that is the Partido de Cast of José Antonio Cast, was a candidate that lost to Boric, who's not his fault, but anyway, the son of I can't remember the name of his father, was a Nazi that escaped from the roots of the Vatican from Italy. And he says, has revindicated Pinochet millions of times. And that was the party that won the most seats in power. And the leader of the Republicanos was Silva, they said Professor Silva, appears in a movie also of Marcela Said that's called The Opus Dei in Chile. And he's interviewed, and he's part of a secta, how do you say, a cult.
A cult, yes.
He's part of a cult, an extremely religious, conservative. So I thought, well, this is also going to fail. And it failed. And to finish now, because people in Chile are afraid of change. Any kind of change. Anything that disturbs the status quo of the little things we have, but we have, and not our neighbors, it's going to be impossible to.
So, yeah, President Boric has said, okay, that's it for constitutional reform for now. We're going to put that on the back burner.
Yeah, because Boric is a president of this country, and the president we have a very strong presidential system, but he doesn't have the tools, because no president has it, to make the changes this country needs, right. And doesn't have the support.
And the political will, probably.
Yeah, because it's very important that a progressive president in Chile can finish his term, because we always have the ghost of the coup, you know?
Yeah.
But it's important, I believe, that he finishes his time in presidency, and that will make space for new options in a more progressive kind of way, you know? And also not have the tools and don't have the political back, as they say, to make those changes, because he can't do it, because you have Congress, because you have, well, the oligarchs, the rich families, and the...
Basically, society is still too divided. There's not the political support which has obviously been evidenced in two rejected constitutions. So yeah, it's still a very difficult constitution, but like Allende said, I have faith in Chile, and I know that Chile will be all right in the end. And I guess, you know, as the younger generation comes into power, maybe that will all change, but I guess we'll see about that. So...
Se abrirán las grandes alamedas. A big avenues will open.
Yes, bigger avenues will open.